setup, and he comes up with numbers like 29 dB of less sensitivity on 10 meters. Now, does that mean that the noise in his environment is 29 dB louder than KTB? KTB is a Boltzmann's constant, temperature and bandwidth. You go through that calculation, that's supposed to tell you how many microvolts or how many dBm is a quiet environment. A 50-ohm resistor at room temperature, so to speak. Let me drop. So Joe did measure 28 or 29 dB of less sensitivity. And one of the experiments Joe was going to do is to use a different method of coupling a signal under working conditions, like another antenna on the QTH of the house, for instance, and another receiver. And so it's beginning to look, Joe, like you really do have 28 dB of excess noise on 28 megacycles in your environment. And so by way of your service monitor, unfortunately a service monitor has got a noise figure of about 25 dB or so, therefore a service monitor connected directly to that antenna may or may not see the source of the noise. Some of the candidates are just broadband noise, fluorescent lighting, a parking lot down the street, band opening where the lightning crashes are all being connected together, so to speak. And so there's hundreds of thunderstorms going on somewhere around the world at all times. So therefore, there's a lot of atmospheric noise, particularly when 10 meters has a band opening. Let me drop. So connecting a spectrum analyzer, and because spectrum analyzers usually have a very high noise figure for a bunch of reasons in order to make them frequency flat, you should have to put some kind of a preamplifier in front of it. So a preamplifier in front of the service monitor or a spectrum analyzer connected to the antenna may give a clue. There may be a service of some kind, 10 megacycles off to one side, that's desensing his receiver. I doubt that, because if he makes the measurement a whole lot of times and comes up with 28 dB of excess noise, for a extraneous transmitter to do that is unlikely, because they're not turning on and turning off. They're turning on and turning off. If it's a broadcast station down the street, yes, that could be doing it, because that's kind of continuous. So give us a few more of those details, Steve. Sounds like what you did. Use different receivers, same results. Different antennas, same results. Maybe Universal also done it with Mobile. By driving around the neighborhood a mile or two away from your house, north, south, east, and west, with your Mobile, if you measured a different amount of desensitization at various locations, that would give you a clue. But I sure wish we had available to you a sensitive spectrum analyzer that could scan 10 megs above or below where you're looking to see if there's any extraneous signal there. Eric last week was also suggesting we use an extremely good bandpass filter that passes nothing but the 28 meg region where you're listening. That would be worth a try. Back to you, Joe, for further information. WA2RYY, K2RYW, the TechNet. You got it, Joe.
Okay, WA2RYY here. Well, I tested the performance by using a different method of one antenna to another antenna, and I purposely put a 10 dB attenuator in the port going to the duplex portion of my signal generator, just so that port would see a pseudo 50 ohm match type of thing. It would theoretically see, like, you know, almost a minus 20 dBm signal, return loss looking out from that port with a 10 dB attenuator. Being that the antenna I was using in both cases is completely not resonant with the frequency, and I was using the antenna I was receiving on into the receive port of the spectrum analyzer. So when I did the second test using the antenna, I came down to effective sensitivity on 10 meters about minus 92 dBm, give or take. That's what it seemed to be. But anything below that, and the receiver would start becoming very noisy. This is also done on a regular, you know, in the FM mode of the radio, using commercial radio in both cases. The effective sensitivity of the same series of radios done back the other way, I had a little more insertion loss by about maybe 1.5, 2 dB measurable from like one antenna to another, about 52 megahertz. And that gave me an effective receive sensitivity about minus 100 to minus 101. so it's a little better to go up in frequency. Now the third test I did, yes, I can see the using the analyzer, I can see the noise content using the spectrum analyzer from the my IFR service monitor, and I see about minus 100. It looks like broadband noise. You can listen to it in the AM mode. It almost sounds like it has 120 cycle component to it. Now, let me drop it. I'm going to tell you what the other test I did in the mobile. Okay, I continue doing the test of the mobile. This time, instead of using a commercial radio, I used an ICOM R7000, which you own one of those yourself, and you know that to be a pretty good receiver. I used it in the wideband mode, which is capable of receiving about plus or minus at least 100 to 200 kilohertz bandwidth at once. Typically, you use that for like FM broadcast reception. But at 29 megahertz, we're looking for the antenna on the car. I hooked that up on the car, and I previously used my signal generator to calibrate the S meter to what I would see like an S9, S5, S6, S7, S9. And S9 on that particular radio gave me about achieved with about a minus 87 dBm signal going into the antenna input of that radio in wideband mode. So when I took that radio, put it out in the car, hooked up to my mobile antenna, I got typically about a little under an S9, give or take, and it's in some places as I drove around my neighborhood within about a half mile, three quarters of a mile, some places I would see up to as much as plus 10 or plus 15 or almost plus 20 dB above S9, which is noise that sometimes you can hear like static crash. It's almost like it was an arcing going on someplace, but continuously, I pretty much had like an S9 reading most of the time. So this is a very bewildering type of problem I'm dealing with as far as the noise level, not just like next to my house, but it's quite spread out over a wide amount of area. Back to you.
Okay, you're starting to get some real data here now, Steve. I mean, just one or two transmissions ago, you saw a 120 cycle component. If you look with an oscilloscope, sunk to the 60 cycle line, and you see a 120 cycle component, that would be strongly indicative of fluorescent lighting, arcing of pulse peak transformers, and whatever. So if that noise has a cyclicity to it of 120, which is double 60 cycles, you know, each half cycle of the 60 cycle, when it goes to positive peak, you get an arc, and when it goes to negative peak, you get an arc, and that arc might be the plasma inside of a fluorescent tube, a zillion of them in a parking lot, or the arcing of a nearby transformer or high voltage wiring, the power distribution system, or the power transmission system in your neighborhood. But the fact that you can drive around and see the noise get louder is another very strong clue. So did you see a 120 cycle component with an oscilloscope? Or maybe you heard it, if you know what you're listening to. Even broadband noise, if it's modulated at 120 hertz, it's got a characteristic sound by way of the ubiquitous spectrum analyzer, acoustic spectrum analyzer that exists in human hearing. You might recognize that. So tell me more about the 120 cycles. Tell me where in your neighborhood you heard the noise the loudest. Was there anything nearby that gives you some clues? Good science experiment you're doing here, Joe. The average person can have 20 and 30 dB of desensitization and never know about it because they never measure this. W2RYY, K2RIW, TechNet, wait for the four beeps.
Well, if it bores you, can go someplace else. I didn't hear that away from the house because I can't use the service monitor in the vehicle. It's not set up to do that right now at the moment. I'm not set up to be able to power that in the vehicle, even though they can run off a 12-volt source. I can't do that because of the amperage it draws. But anyway, that's for another time. That I happened to notice off the house. And the service monitor has a function inside where you can put things on tone and switch the horizontal. You switch the settings to basically compare what you look on the scope or what you see demodulated. You can beat it against one of the tone generators internally from the IFR, so you can do a compare type of thing using a listening pattern. You can easily do that by just throwing a couple switches. So that That's what it seemed to get. It did seem to stop at 60 cycles. It seemed to be pretty much consistently 120 hertz, but that was looking at this broadband noise. When the static I saw on the R7000 went up much higher, up to 10, plus 15, maybe sometimes almost plus 20 over S9, I didn't have the service monitor with me, so but that in the AM mode sounded very similar, like 120 cycle buzz coming out of the speaker of the receiver. Back to you.
Yeah, there's a characteristic sound that your hearing will pick up in the loudspeaker of your phone if the noise is modulated at 120 hertz. Apparently you did hear that, and that's a partial confirmation. When you drove around the neighborhood with your mobile and you got the loudest noise, where were you, what's nearby, and do you think you found that peak? In other words, as you keep driving in that direction, did it keep getting louder? Over to you, Joe.
As I got near one power distribution plant that's near me, it's actually about 3/4 mile south of my house, west of that, at one particular intersection is where I saw this signal come up the highest. I believe the lines coming out of this thing are either 37 or 69 kV lines. I don't know that for sure. But as I got near those lines, that's where I really saw this thing peak up, but only at one particular intersection. So it's kind of hard to pinpoint it.
So it does sound like a lot of your power line equipment, power distribution system is implicated. The fact that you're hearing a component, and the fact that it gets louder when you get near a power station, that sounds like what a lot of it is. If you had a Yagi antenna on any of these bands where you're hearing it, 6, 10, 6, 2 meters, 450. I do remember with my array of 16 Yagis, which you can see on my QSL card, there were specific directions I could aim that antenna on 432 and hear a hell of a lot more broadband noise with a 120 cycle component to it. And when I was on top of my tower and looking in that direction with binoculars, sure enough, I would see high tension, you know, 345 kilovolt transmission system lines in certain directions. They were giving me noise all the way up to 432. So that sounds like what you're getting, Joe. And that's a tough one to solve. If you found a particular pole pig transformer on a particular utility pole that's noisier than most because it's got an arcing insulator, and you report that serial number of that pole to the right person at the ConEd Loco, you know what I mean, sometimes you can get improvements. Are there any parking lots with a whole lot of fluorescent lighting or sodium vapor lighting or any kind of plasma-like lighting? Are there any parking lots and shopping centers within a few miles of your house, Joe? W2RYY, K2RIW, the second end.
Oh, sure there are. I'm only about a mile and a quarter from town, so there's plenty of stores up there that have more fluorescent lighting running. And going north the other way up towards past the main highway, there's Kmart. So, there is fluorescent lighting in different directions. Whether the signal or this level of noise would be emitted by them and travel that far to me, I don't know. I would think if it's coming from them, I'd be able to drive up to them with a mobile installation and do some DFing and get a fairly strong signal. The other thing I did do is using the service monitor in a wider mode than 1 megahertz per division. You can't, even at 1 meg per division, receiver will receive. If you go past that, it won't receive. You won't get decoded audio. But what I did notice is hooking it to my television antenna and listening to it at about 50 megahertz, which is still within the bandpass of the antenna and preamp assembly that I use, I did notice like line static type of noise that went up as high as minus 75, but I can't tell because the gain of the amplifiers what the actual level would be, whether it's just an antenna or no amplification on it. But that indication seemed to be west of my house and about south of my house. So anyways, from 180 degrees to 270, the noise seemed to be about the strongest, but it wasn't pinpointed in one particular direction. Listening at about 50 megahertz or so. It didn't diminish that much going in other direction like 090 degrees or 000 degrees.
There's a lot of missing information there that's clearing your head, but you didn't tell us. When you were measuring these directions of reception on your television aerial, you're a television DXer. You're one of the rare guys that has a rotator on that antenna. Now, by rotating your television aerial, you can find out directions of strongest signal. Based on the assumption that your television aerial has a good front-to-side, front-to-back ratio, which is not bad. However, the method by which they make a television aerial cover 50 megacycles to 470 megs and beyond, to make an antenna have high gain and be flattening gain and good pattern across all of that frequency region, all of those octaves, impossible. So at certain frequencies, every television aerial has got some funny lobes in its antenna pattern. But I'm pretty sure that, but I am assuming, Joe, that that directionality, when you measured your television aerial noise, is by way of the rotator. And there's no simple solution for what you're running into, Joe. You're in a noisy environment. You're going to have to buy a house on top of a mountain somewhere far away from civilization. I'm kidding, of course. W-R-Y-Y, K-Q-R-I-W, that'd be great, Joe.
Well, I'll just have to continue it for another week, and maybe somebody else has got another idea, something else I could possibly try. Coming up in a can, to isolate my receiver on 10 megahertz is pretty much out of the question. I don't have access to that kind of stuff. That'd be like an old Casey transmitter can from like 3522, which you could probably tune down, but I don't have access to that kind of stuff, so I have no filtering available to be isolated. But using this analyzer in a very wide scan mode, like 10, a 5 or 10 megahertz per division on a, listening on the vertical antenna, the only strongest signal I really saw was maybe something in the shortwave band at about minus 40 dBm, so it was around 13, 14 megahertz. That was about the strongest thing, besides broadcast stations up to 100 meg.
That shortwave signal, I presume that was a foreign broadcast. And roughly how many megs away was that is question number one. Question number two, although Eric thinks there's nothing to be lost by some means getting a hold of a somewhat narrow band filter favoring your 28 meg region or your 50 meg region, that would be helpful. But if the noise is like I suspect it is, sodium vapor, fluorescent lighting, any of these things that have an internal plasma that makes extremely broadband noise, DC to light, so to speak, over the frequency region. Broadband noise, when you filter it with a narrowband filter, doesn't change the noise power the receiver's going to see. It just changes the peak noise power. If you've got a filter that's got scanning 10 megs as opposed to a filter that's scanning a 10 kilohertz, the peak power of the noise will be lower on the 10 kilohertz. But the noise power per kilohertz on the narrow filter versus the wide filter, in almost all cases, is the same. So, although it's worth a try, it's a long shot. I guess that environment you've got, Joe, is going to make you favor the higher microwave frequencies. Let me drop. One of the basic laws of physics is that when you're using something that generates broadband noise, like a spark gap, the plasma inside of a fluorescent tube, sodium vapor light, anything that makes broadband noise, the laws of physics dictate that that noise falls off 6 dB per octave as you go up in frequency. So you choose a high enough frequency, 2 meters, 450, 1296, the noise gets weaker and weaker, 6 dB per octave, and although it's there, your ham radio operations on the higher frequencies will give you more pleasure. The noise will become more and more insignificant. That's one possible solution. Another possible solution is that if it does favor certain directions, and if now you establish a good high-gain antenna, a well-designed Yagi or a stack of Yagis, and you choose the direction where you're talking to your ham radio friends that are away from those sources of noise, that will help. So you can use directional selectivity, frequency selectivity going to higher bands, and so on. The ways you can make it better, but I think there's not going to be, from what we're hearing, any glamour fix that's going to make it disappear. Over to you, Joe, K2LIW, the TechNet.
Okay, yeah, pretty much, would understand that the higher frequency, and I did prove that out by making the same kind of measurements at 146 megahertz with my other commercial radio. I had about a 3-4 dB degradation up on a frequency that high, so I could see right away as it went higher. higher frequency, the effect would be becoming a lot more minimal. So, but if I want to run lower frequencies, it's going to be a problem. You know, and I can even see the noise level if I put the my HF transceiver on the, you know, my vertical antenna that's outside the coast for about maybe 20 megs to 30 meg, which resonant best to 29. I can see broadband noise on pretty much a lot of the lower HF bands. It's pretty high level. That's something you can see. Of course, when I go to FSB, it diminishes on the meter, and it's maybe not quite as much of a problem, but, you know, still, it's still there. If it's something I could solve as far as finding where it's coming from, that'd be great, but doesn't seem to appear to be the case right now. I haven't found the pinpoint the source of it. It might be something that's, you know, being generated all over the place, but I'm just wondering with these high-tension, high-voltage lines, like either 37 kV or 69 kV, if you've got something really bad at one particular junction point, can the lines themselves tend to radiate that signal along the lines, even though it's initially coming from starting at a lower frequency, but can the lines themselves start acting like an antenna at some particular frequencies?
The answer to that, Joe, is absolutely yes. If you had the arcing of a high tension line, 59 kilovolt, 348, 5 kilovolt, whatever it is, well, many of the transmission lines on Long Island are qualified for 345, but they're being used at something like 120,000 volts. They're qualified at twice the voltage they're being used at. But what I'm getting at is, if something is doing arcing, that line is simultaneously an antenna and a transmission line. So that signal walks down that line, and it's being leaked off that line continuously. And if it's a really high tension line where it happens to be arcing everywhere along the length, then it's one hell of a distributed antenna. So yes, I did see that kind of an effect. When I had a 5-degree beamwidth antenna, 5.5-degree beamwidth of those 16 Yagis on 432, I could aim them at a very specific region where I'm looking down the length of a high voltage transmission system of Loco at that time, and I'm looking in one particular direction. I'm looking down a length of those as if you're looking down a set of railroad tracks, if you know what I mean. And boy, did I see a peak of noise on 432 in that direction, day in and day out. So as you put up higher gain rotatable antennas that favor your ham radio signal, that'll help. Single sideband will help, because the more narrow the bandwidth of your reception system, the less of the noise power you see when you drop. And if anyone had asked me, with everything that I know, my experience, as how much excess noise is there at 28 megs by way of atmospheric effects that mankind has to put up with, I would have said 10, 15, 20 dB of excess. I would have said 10 or 15 dB of excess noise on 28 megs. Yes, you've got 30 and 40 dB of excess noise way down there at 80 meters. But I wouldn't have chosen that high on 28 megs, and where you've made measurements that are to some degree traceable to the Bureau, calibrated test equipment, I'm reasonably sure it's real, and you and I are both amazed that it's that high. Keep hacking away at it, Joe, but you're not going to get a glamour fix on this one. You're going to make various improvements, as we've already discussed. Bye-bye for now, and go over to Joe number 2, KC2QYW. Let's see how those electrons in Harrison, New York are treating him. Go right ahead, Joe, K2YW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Hey, Dick, I want to say happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there who's listening. I think I'm in the mobile right now. I think I'm in a bad spot right now. My question to you is about QSL cards. I ordered 100 of them. My question to you is, do you think I should order the Sony ones compared to the regular paper ones? That's my question to you. I think I might have ordered the wrong ones. And I guess, do people still mail out QSL cards to people, or is everybody going green and we're going paperless? Okay, back to the net.
Yeah, people are using internet techniques to transmit QSO cards as opposed to real paper. I'm going to pass that around for people to give their opinion of that. It is my belief that there's still a hell of a lot of people out there that like collecting cards. They like putting them in these plastic holders, stacking them on the wall, and so on. There's a good number of people who really want a card in front of them to confirm that QSO. And when it comes to the various awards given out by the ARRL, in the past, until very recently for sure, you went up there with a stack of cards proving you made all those QSOs in order to get a WAC, WES, and whatever award, 5-band DXCC. You needed paper cards. Could you walk up there with a computer program? I guess you could, but I haven't heard about that. So, and when you buy cards, I know the first time I bought cards, like you, I bought 100. And I thought they would last forever. And I burned through those real fast. If you got them, let me drop them. If you got a card design that you like in my particular case, there's a particular picture of me standing on top of my 100-foot tower. I'm standing in the middle of this 400-foot square array of 16 Yankees on 432. So I'm standing in the middle of this antenna, 100 feet above the ground. So it's kind of an exciting picture. It's on the front end of my red QSO card. So I knew I'm going to be using that card for a long time. And lucky for me, I bought the second time I bought the card, I think I bought either 500 or 1,000. So if you've got a card you're really going to like, and you don't think you're going to have to change it a whole lot, 100 is too small a number. The price is not that high if you go to the right place. And you'd be amazed how fast you're going to burn through them if you're a really active guy. And to repeat, I think there's a hell of a lot of people that want cards, that want paper. But let's see if other people out there have got an opinion on that. I'm not a DXer these days, and you guys are. So what percentage of the population is accepting electronic card as opposed to a real paper card? Give me a call, let us, if you've got an opinion on that subject, right now. K2RIW, the Tech National. Okay, we hear Rich GXM. Go right in with your comment, Rich, and give us a little bit more audio, Rich. You're kind of light.
Thanks, Dick. I'll do what I can. I collect UFO cards like crazy. Comment. Make sure the side you write on is not glossy. Glossy will give you lots of headaches. Also, Dick, I'd like to welcome Hal back. I missed you, buddy. And you can take my name off the list. WBGXMF.
Yeah, that's a good point. Certain kinds of writing with ballpoint pens and whatever on glossy is a real problem. So whether the front end is glossy so that you can not write on it anymore could be a bit of a pain. But I think the impression we're getting, Joe, is that a hell of a lot of people want a paper card to confirm that QSO, and it certainly is going to make life a lot easier when you have this pile of cards that allows you to get a beautiful certificate, an award, and you walk those cards up to ARRL or anywhere else that's got a person who officially can do the checking for you. It's very nice for him to flip through those cards and confirm it. WB2GXM, Mobile, I believe. K2RIW in the TechNet. Oh, wait a minute. Sorry about that. KC2QIW. Wrong guy. Joe. KC2QIW. Mobile. K2RIW. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, roger that. Yeah, so I did order them. It's not the glossy ones, it's the paper ones. And yeah, I do like the cards. I do like them. It's a lot of fun. And can you still send it out on 2 meters too? Like if you're talking on 2 meters, you can send it out to people on 2 meters, because I think a few people send two of them when I'm talking on 2 meters too. And yeah, these are like the first cards I ever ordered. And someone referred me to what's that website? CheapQSLCards.com or something like that. So yeah, I like the cards, you know. Just think I like listening to records. Yeah, almost the same thing in a way. So all right, back to the net.
Okay, Joe. Good luck with those cards. And on 2 meters, do people people send back and forth cards, not very often, because the 2 meter QSO, particularly on a repeater, it's not an unusual event that needs confirmation. Some people do it as a pure courtesy. I mean, it is a particular guy that you really like talking to. You have a schedule with him every Tuesday night, and to send him a card with some kind of a message on it, as a friendly gesture, yes, that could be a lot of fun. But not many people are sending out 2 meter cards for repeater QSOs, sideband QSOs. And by the way, there's lots of people who operate 2 meters with FM repeaters for years of their life and don't even know there's another world out there of 2 meters. You go down to 144.200, the single sideband section of the band, with the right kind of a low noise preamp front end and the right kind of a Yagi on the chimney of the house, you'll be amazed at what kind of simplex range these guys are getting. A guy with a 100-watt amplifier, a good Yagi antenna on 2 meters on the chimney of the house, as long as his house is not buried in the valley somewhere, and we drop it. Most days of the week, he'll be talking to people in Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire. He'll be talking to New England. He'll be talking to Maryland, Delaware, Virginia, occasionally North Carolina. He'll be talking to Pennsylvania. Occasionally out to Ohio. This is a single sideband, 100 watts. You'd be amazed at the kind of range you can get, because sideband has got so much more sensitivity. So even though you're on a 2 meter band right now, there's another 2 meter band with some exciting, very different characteristics. On top of that, the people who are using sideband, in general, I have reason to believe they have a slightly higher IQ, or at least technical IQ. They talk about real technical subjects to each other. So if you want to dig into radio science, so to speak, the sideband people might be a little bit more what you'd like. As we said so many times before, it's 26 different kinds of ham radio. Sideband versus FM are two of those kinds. And so try some of the others. Extremely educational hobby, and some of those other portions of the hobby might really tickle your fancy. Rich, WB2GXM, go right ahead with your question. K2RIW in the TechNet.
WB2GXM. Dick, actually, I did just want to wish Al welcome back. No comments or questions from me tonight, because I'm enjoying the net every week. WB2GXM out.
Very fine, then. By the way, you guys are listening to an ordinary Kenwood, oldie but goodie, Kenwood TS711A 2 meter all mode rig. And I can't even see the model number of the microphone that comes with it. The nice thing about the Kenwood rig is that it's got a speech processor. If you press this button, which I've done, I'm using the speech processor. I'm about to turn off the speech processor. There's my rig without the speech processor. And as you can tell, the audio is not as loud and not as, doesn't have as much punch to it as the speech processor turned back on. So the design of that speech processor is so good. This ordinary microphone, this somewhat ordinary rig, is what I've been using all of these years to run the TechNet. There are people who meet me in person and they say, gee, this voice is nowhere near as exciting. He must have very well tailored audio or whatever on the rig that he uses for running the TechNet. It's kind of ordinary. So sorry to hear that. You meet me in person, my voice is not anywhere near as exciting as what I'm hearing.
K2UPS has a comment.
Go right ahead there, Rich. K2UPS, he's one of the very exciting guys. He's out there in his mobile rig for the UPS company. I am guessing he's in Ohio or Pennsylvania. So tell us first where you are, Rich, and tell us anything you'd want to. He's a guy with a lot of experience. K2, Uncle Papa Sierra, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Rich.
K2UPS Mobile, good evening, Dick, and the rest of the men. I'm in West Virginia on the way back home, outside of Wheeling. Just had a comment for the gentleman with the QSL cards. They are still being used, not as much as they used to, but I enjoy both sending and receiving the cards. It's nice that you can personalize it a little bit more than just buying a stock card that has your call on it. If you can add some drawing a picture, somehow personalize it a little bit, that makes it a little bit nicer. If you don't want to spend the money and buy 100 of really nice cards, you can design them on your computer and then either print them out on an inkjet on photo paper, or go down to the local CVS or Walgreens that have these little Kodak kiosks in there, and you can buy just 5 or 10 at a time if you want to send out. And if there's a card that you'd really want to get back from somebody, the proper thing to do is include an SASE in with your card so that it's less postage, obviously, for him to send it back to you. If you really don't care to get one back, then the SASE isn't necessary. But if you spoke to somebody in a rare country or rare state or whatever, first contact, anything like that, and you really want to get a QSL card from them, check QRZ.com first to see if the guy will QSL via paper. A lot of guys indicate in their profile there whether it will or not, and if he does, then send an SASE if you really want that card. So that was just my comment. Stick back to that.
Very good information, Rich, and I thank you. When you do send a guy in a foreign country a self-addressed stamped envelope because you really want a card back from him, the next problem he's got is the postage required. I am reasonably sure that if we put American postage on that card, he cannot mail it in his country. And for us to get a hold of the foreign stamp that his country uses and put that on the SSE, I suspect that's a very difficult process and difficult to do. Therefore, you mail him I forget what it's called. It's a method by which you can give him official cash through the post office system. I'm going to guess that the average guy does it with a so-called green stamp. In other words, you give him a real 1, 2, or 3 American dollar bill, because in almost every country, that does have some value. So if you want that card back as bad enough, one of the various methods, Rich, that you know about, that you're able to put postage on that SASE envelope that he's about to use that will be accepted in his country. K2UPS, Mobile, West Virginia.
Well, green stamps are always an option, but you got to be careful that you then don't put any call signs or radio information on the outside of the envelope to the person you're sending it to, because some countries, once they see that, know what's going on, will open up and take the green stamps out for themselves. And then the guy at the end won't get it. The other thing that I think you're trying to think of is the IRC, or International Reply Coupon. I know our post office for a while has stopped issuing them. There was some discrepancies, I think, with dates and when they were going to expire, but I believe they are available again. You can use that. You can also use the QSL bureaus. There are different ones that you can send your cards to in bulk, then they send them out, and it's much cheaper because you only pay per pound of cards as opposed to paying per each card. The only drawback there is it can take a year or two, or sometimes even longer, to get the card back again. But it's a heck of a lot cheaper than doing it direct. Again, it all comes down to how bad you really want the card. But with the electronic QRZ profiles, most people do fill out whether they only use Logbook of the World or only use EQSL, or they'll do all. You know, they'll do paper logs. But if you try to get a paper QSL out of a guy who states right there, "I don't do paper QSLs," you just, you know, going in the wind here. You ain't going to get it back. Back to you, Dick.
Hey, you've gotten quite a few of these awards, I believe, Rich, where you needed confirmation and you'd like to have QSL card. If you try to do it electronically, in other words, if you use electronic QSLs, how well accepted are those? Is there a method by which I can have a whole lot of my countries giving me a QSL card electronically, I presume that means through the internet, and then how do I then transport that information to the American Radio Relay League so I get the award? Is there a universal, I guess you did tell us, QRZ, something of the world, you know what I mean? I don't know the name of it. Is that a method by which it's universally accepted? So give us a few details as to how I can electronically get a QSL card and get it accepted with very little question at ARRL for that next award. K2UPS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, the only electronic one that the league is going to accept is theirs, which is Logbook of the World, or LOTW. There are other ones out there, EQSL, and I think even a few other more obscure ones. They're not recognized by anybody except themselves. So you can get on EQSL and get all sorts of QSLs that way electronically, but the only award you're going to get is one from EQSL. Now, some guys like that, some guys don't. They want to have the awards from the league. The only way to get them electronically through the league is through Logbook of the World. Now, you do not have to be a member of the ARRL to use Logbook of the World, but it's all done, you know, electronically. The other get the foreign station or the station you're talking to submits his log. It's all encrypted. You submit your log, and then the league compares the two, and if they match up, then you will get credit for making that contact. But that's the only way to do it. It's some guys love the system, some guys hate it, but that's the options that you have.
Of all the QSOs that of the heavy certificate hunters you know of, Rich, roughly what percentage are now using Logbook of the World and are happy with it? Has it gotten as high as 50% of the hams that are really looking for awards? Are they all essentially accepting Logbook of the World? Has it gotten that high yet, Rich? K2UPS, K2RIW?
I don't really know what the percentage is, but it's, it goes up every year. And I know if you're a big DX and you follow the DX petitions around the world, and you work them, if they're able to have a satellite link or a phone link from their location, many of them update, if not once a day, sometimes it within like a half an hour of working them or less. Sometimes it seems like it's real time. You can actually go to Logbook and see the confirmation come up. So, I mean, there's no waiting for them to send in the mail. It doesn't take months. You know, it can be quick, but it depends on the system that they have set up at that particular DX location. It is a lot easier. It's a heck of a lot cheaper because, you know, there's no postage involved. So, but some guys, like I said, still enjoy getting a card from different entities.
I've got another question for you, Rich. You're sounding particularly good tonight. I hear a tiny little bit of hiss in the background, which I believe is the wind at 60 miles an hour whistling by the window of your truck as going by those two great big side view mirrors that you've got with the antenna hanging off those mirrors. I'm joking a little bit. I'm guessing that there are people listening to you driving through West Virginia and like to know how is your signal in real time getting to this repeater. I'm not sure you're doing it by Echolink. I think you're doing it through a cell phone. I'm guessing your cell phone dials a particular number that gets directly into this repeater. Give us a few words as to how you're doing it so successfully, Rich. You sound good. K2UPS Mobile in West Virginia. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Big, well, I cut the mic gain rack a little bit. I had it up different links. I need different mic gain setting, but it is Echolink. It's running on my smartphone, an Android phone, and I'm using a Bluetooth headset into the cell phone, and then it goes over the internet. So I'm not dialing any phone numbers or anything.
Okay, so it's an internet connection through your cell phone into Echolink is what we're hearing. Boy, I think this electronics is going to catch on. I can remember 20 years ago when cell phones were just starting to become popular. I was predicting that the day will come that a person will be in New Zealand, so to speak, or Australia, and with a camera of some kind, he's going to take a picture electronically with a CCD array in the camera. Electronically, by some means, he's going to couple that into a cellular telephone. He's going to call up his buddy in Los Angeles and say, I'm sorry, I woke you up at 3 o'clock in the morning, but here I am in New Zealand seeing this beautiful sunset, and I'd like to share it with you. I was predicting that 20 years ago. Well, we've come a long way since then. My goodness. Now the cell phone is the camera. The coupling of the data into the camera, into the internet is automatic, and boy, we can send anything to anybody. And when crimes take place these days, people are taking movies of the crimes taking place with their cell phone. And the guys, particularly in many of the foreign countries, they carry a kind of a camera, I guess, I forget what they call it, a camera on the dashboard of their car, looking forward, which gives them a lot of information as far as accidents are concerned. So I think this electronics, you couple a computer with a piece of radio wireless electronics, I think it's going to catch on. There's a joke there. Next person on the list was Steve. And thank you, Rich, for all that info. Steve, KD2, HUC. How are those electrons treating you tonight? K2RW. Go ahead, Steve.
Good evening, Dick. The electrons are giving me grief. And it's very interesting that we were just talking about QSL cards because I haven't gotten a single one, and that leads me into my question for this evening. Let me let it drop. I have a DXCC that I'm waiting to install. That's a multi-band dipole. It's still in the bag. At the recommendation of my Elmer, I threw up a long wire antenna. It's approximately 90 feet long. It's supported between my chimney and a tree in my backyard. I have RG213 running up about 100 feet from the shack out to the top of the chimney. Let me let it drop. I have an MFJ tuner that seems to be able to work well with the combination. I'm seeing SWRs at the transceiver of, 2-to-1 or less. And all is happy with, by the transceiver. The performance is leaving me a lot to be desired. So I've been having some conversations with some people, and my feeling is that I'm end feeding this wire, and that the SWR between the tuner and the wire is, very, very high, which I did validate. I hooked up an SWR meter between the tuner and the long wire, and it was so high I couldn't measure it. But the transceiver is not seeing any of that. My question is, could this high SWR, when coupled, the fact that it's bouncing back and forth through this feed line, this coax, can I be suffering, extreme power loss? Am I losing a lot of my energy to the cable as heat? That's pretty much my question. KD2, HUC, back to net.
Very fine, Steve, and you sound good. And I found out by listening on the input that you're using the 975-375 input from COMAC as opposed to the 2585. And I'm amazed that the audio is sounding that good. It looks like Eric's done a very good job of lining up that audio. You're right on, Steve. When you've got an end-fed antenna that's either half-wave resonant, which gives it something like a 2,000 ohm impedance, or non-resonant at all, which means that it's not only a 2,000 ohm impedance, but highly reactive, maybe even 3,000 ohms of capacitive reactance if you were using it on 80 meters, for instance, or 40 meters. Yes, without a doubt, an extremely high VISWR on the cable makes a hell of a lot of extra loss. The only people I know of who have done direct feeding of an antenna that we know has a high VISWR because of the way you're feeding it at one end or the length that it is and so on. Let me drop. The only people who have got away with that with the high performance are the people who feed it with ladder line. 600 ohm open wire line, 450 ohm open wire line. The ladder line, open wire line, has extremely low loss and has a very good track record of tolerating extremely high VISWR. A quality piece of coax cable like RG8, RG213, RG214 has a lot of history of guys who try to feed a very poorly resonant antenna, high VISWR antenna with coax, and they all complain about a lot of extra loss. People don't hear them. They're not very loud. So I think you're right on, and you hit it on the head. You've got at least two or three solutions on this one, Steve. Number one, flip over the ladder line is the classic approach, but now you've got to have the right kind of an antenna tuner or the right kind of equipment that will properly feed the ladder line in a differential manner. In other words, you want to put the... If the right-hand wire of your open wire line is going to be plus 100 volts, you want at that same instant the left-hand wire to be exactly minus 100 volts on that particular half cycle, if you know what I mean. Thoroughly differential feeding it, and you get very low insertion loss. So, ladder line as a transmission line instead of your RG213, that's one possible solution. Let me drop. At least at one band at a time. There's another classic solution. It turns out that your 100-foot piece of wire at each of the frequencies you care about has a clearly defined impedance. Ain't that something? You go to the so-called Brown and Woodward impedance curves for a piece of wire. You can find those curves on LimarkTechNet.com and QRZ and then AmateurRadio.tv. In either case, particularly on the LimarkTechNet.com, that's Joe number 2's website. You will find Mike number 2, sorry about that. Yeah, LimarkTechNet.com. You will find this impedance matching article by K2RIW, perfect impedance matching of a dipole or a Yagi. Anyhow, you'll find these Brown and Woodward curves. Let me tell you what that means. All you got to do is know the diameter of your wire and the length of your wire. And therefore, the impedance is clearly defined. There's two separate curves, there are two separate graphs. One graph tells you the resistive impedance, the other graph tells you the reactive impedance. So, with rather high accuracy, the exact impedance of your antenna being fed the way you're feeding it. And there's a little bit of error because the ground reflection is going to change this a little bit. Close enough. Once you know the impedance of your antenna, you then go to the Berkeley website. Simply Google the word impedance matching plus Berkeley, B-E-R-K-E-L-E-Y. You'll get this beautiful website where it says, what is the impedance of your load? They want to know the resistive component and the reactive component. You tell them. What's the impedance of your signal generator? You're going to tell them 50 ohms, that's your transmitter. And then you press go. And that program in 1 second will give you 16 solutions where you make this LC network, an L network, an inverted L network, a pi network, a T network. Choose the one you like. It tells you exactly how many microhenry and exactly how many picofarads of capacitor and inductor will give you a perfect impedance match at the antenna. And by the way, for you to come up with that capacitor and that inductor by winding it on a piece of winding a piece of wire on a PVC piece of tubing. Let me drop. There's many websites that'll tell you how to do that, but the early chapters of the Radio Amateur's Handbook will tell you that if you're winding a coil, and the coil is this number of inches in diameter, and you've got this much spacing between the turns, and you've got this number of turns, that equation in there will tell you exactly how many microamperes the coil's going to give you. You can homebrew the coil, you can homebrew the capacitor, you can build this network, and you can weatherproof it, and you hang it at the end of the coax cable, and now that becomes an impedance matching network, one inductor and one capacitor is the one you're probably going to choose. You hang that at the end of your coax cable going into your particular piece of wire. It'll give you nearly a perfect impedance match right there at that frequency. Now your transmission line is feeding what it thinks is a 50 ohm antenna, and it'll have very little insertion loss. That's one solution. It's a beautiful solution. There's a problem. It works at one band at a time, and maybe in the worst case it only works at one section of the band. If you find that exact solution for the 3.95, 3950 kilohertz upper end of the 80 meter band, it may not be a good enough match at the low end of the 80 meter band, but it's a hell of a lot better than what you've got. And then you might need a different network for 40 meters. There is a method. Let me drop. There is a method by which you can design a more complicated impedance matching network, kind of a duplexer, where it operates on the 80 meter band and the 40 meter band simultaneously. Possible. That's not easy. Maybe you're going to do it with two separate networks and a remotely controlled switch. You send some DC voltage up the coax cable and by way of an RF choke, it feeds, it closes a relay and flips you from impedance matching network on 80 meters over to impedance matching network number 2 on 40 meters. So you can form an exact impedance match at the antenna that way. You can feed it with open wire line, or you can change the length of your wire. Your wire doesn't have to be flat out straight just because you call it radiated. Let me drop it.
K2UPS has a question for you, Dick. On subject.
We'll get to UPS in a couple of seconds. There's nothing magic about your wire that you call radiated being flat out, parallel to the ground, or pure vertical. You can zigzag it in all kinds of ways. You can drop down the end. You can raise the middle. You can drop the middle. You can zigzag it in all kinds of ways so that electronically it has the right length to give you a good impedance at your favorite frequency. There's lots of ways you can add doodads to that wire. You can create a top hat capacitor, but the tail end of the wire, you put a piece of wire at right angles going off to the right and another one going off to the left. You've now made a poor man's equivalent of a top hat capacitor, which has taken your 100 foot of wire and made it electronically act like 132 feet, and now it's a perfect halfway dipole on 80 meters, so to speak. So there's lots of ways you can force the wire to be resonant. There's lots of ways you can impedance match it right at the end of the coax cable, and you can feed it with open wire line that can tolerate tremendously high standing wave ratio without giving you extra insertion loss. These are some of the solutions. So before I pass it back to you, Rich and Steve, let me go over to Rich and see what he's got to ask on this subject, because when it comes to making an antenna, let me backtrack on that one. You have to resonate first before it will radiate. You're forcing the resonance to take place by way of your antenna tuner in the shack at the far end of a lossy piece of coax cable. Lossy as far as this high vis wire condition is concerned. Let me drop it. You have to resonate before it will radiate, but you can force it to resonate the way you're doing it with the antenna tuner, a slightly lossy way of doing it. You can force it to resonate with an impedance matching LC network at the end of the coax cable going into the antenna. You can put inductors and capacitors and whatever, loading coils, inside of the antenna itself, making it a multi-band antenna. You can change the electrical length of the antenna in a zillion ways. Top hat capacitors, zigzagging it, dropping down the ends, adding loading coils and resonating networks in the antenna. There's a zillion ways you can force the antenna to resonate with a nice standing wave ratio on all of the bands that you care about. I didn't say it's easy, but it's very doable. I'll see what Rich has got to say in all this. K2UPS, mobile in West Virginia, K2IW and TechNet. You got it, Rich.
Making the coax to that end-fed wire, a long wire, but it was using an onion of some sort. But if he has a properly wound 9-to-1 onion, he's feeding it with coax without using a tuner, his highest SWR will probably only be about 2.5-to-1, most likely on 10 megahertz, or 30 meters. The other band, it should be significantly below 2-to-1, and that's without using the tuner. But there, a random length wire or random length wire antenna is a little bit of a misnomer. There are certain lengths that work better than others when you're trying to get them to load up on multi-bands. I think he mentioned 90-some-odd feet. 98.5 feet is a good length, or 88.5 feet is a good length. There are many other lengths, but that's in the ballpark on each side of what I heard him mention. But either one of those two lengths, feeding it at the determination of the coax with the 9-to-1 on him, will give you very good results on pretty much 160 through 10 meters. It'll load up without any difficulty. You can run counterpoise wires off of that also, or you can let the shield of the coax radiate, but then you're going to want to have a 1-to-1 or an RF choke on the coax before it comes into the shack. If he clarified, because I did not hear him say how he was making the connection from the coax to the wire, Dick.
That's a very good point there, Rich.
KI3NDA, question.
Sound like KI3NDA. We're going to get to you in a second, sir. Because the antenna is being fed at one end, and we're not quite sure